Leaders Radio podcast. Today I'm talking with David Llewellyn-Smith, Leif Van Onselen and Callum Pickering of CP Economics about the 2016 Australian Federal Budget. Okay, David, the budget was brought down on Tuesday night. Let's start with the underpinning assumptions. How credible did you find them?
The underpinning assumptions of the budget were, in my view, extremely optimistic. The headline numbers are not too bad. They are forecasting 2.5% GDP growth in 2016-17, which doesn't seem too bad, but when you look at the composition of it, it becomes very difficult to see how you can actually get there. For instance, they're projecting 2% growth in dwelling investment, which we know is very unlikely given the ABS numbers for starts and soon enough completions are near a peak. Business investment is supposed to fall just 5% when the ABS CapEx report is already still indicating minus 18. Moving down the list, their exports were okay. The other big number that they used that was probably highly questionable was 1.6% labour productivity growth to underpin some income growth. And at the moment, labour productivity is falling and has been for a year or so that's extremely unlikely. And probably the biggest fudge, if not outright lie, was a deferral to the existing iron ore pricing methodology, which was to simply take the last few weeks before the budget average price and extrapolate that out for the next sort of about 15 months. And that threw up a price of $55 free on board, which is equivalent of roughly $60 CFR. That's the spot price. Futures are currently pricing about $43 in Singapore, about $50 in China. And if you look at sell-side research, most of the investment banks have got $40 to $45. So the iron ore price was absurdly aggressive. And the methodology simply needs to be overhauled. It needs to be thrown out and redone. And so as a result of that, they had some quite aggressive nominal growth forecasts for the year, 4.25%, which we simply won't get anywhere near, in my view, because all of those crucial numbers will miss. And from there, you know, you proceed to the deficits and various other measures that flow from these assumptions, and they all become pretty laughable as a result.
Callum Pickering, were your thoughts about the budget any more positive than that?
Well, in terms of the economic forecast, I think David has pretty much summed things up pretty accurately. I mean, the big problem is obviously the investment estimates along with the iron ore estimates, and sort of once you tug at those, the whole thing just sort of falls apart, which is a little bit, I guess, unfortunate for the budget overall. I mean, they're currently forecasting that the underlying budget balance will be about -2.2 for 2016-17. You know, they might get near that, but, you know, it's quickly going to fall apart to the point where, you know, 3 or 4 years down the track, we could quite plausibly still be at that sort of 2 to 2.5 deficit level.
That carries a number of implications, which we'll get to in just a few minutes. But before we do, Leif, did you find anything more positive about the budget from a policy angle, starting with superannuation?
Yeah, look, the super reforms are probably the best part about the budget. Now, it's quite amazing. We've gone from, in just one election cycle, basically gone from, you know, we will not touch super and not really even being on the radar to suddenly having actual reform, which is pretty good, to be quite honest. It's one of those things where it probably doesn't go as far as I would have liked, but it goes further than what I was actually expecting from the government, so I was quite happy in that respect. And there were some good bits in that they actually did make some of the changes retrospective, so they've put a cap on how big super balances people can accumulate and still, you know, pay no tax on, which won't just apply to people in the future, it'll actually apply to people who are in the super system right now, which is great. And they've also put in a whole bunch of caps and annual caps on super contributions and that kind of thing. And importantly, they're maintaining the low income super offset, which the Abbott government wanted to get rid of. So I was actually pretty happy with the superannuation side. There was a few other little things in there which were positive. They're giving some funding towards the inland freight railway linking Melbourne and Brisbane, which has been one of those projects that Australia should have done maybe 50 years ago. But finally, there's a bit of money going that way. On the negative side, although it'll benefit me personally, the $80,000 tax threshold is going to increase to $87,000. That's good for some of us, but it's actually pretty inequitable in that they'll only apply to the top 25% taxpayers, and most of them are men. So the bottom 75% taxpayers won't get any relief, which is a bit unfair. And also, they want to progressively cut the company tax from 30% down to 20% over a decade, which is pretty dubious policy. Chris Richardson's come out and said it'll cost the budget about $50 billion. The Australian Institute today has come out and said it'll cost in a decade's time about $20 billion a year. And we also found out that the Prime Minister hasn't actually gotten Treasury to do any modelling on it, which is a bit of a concern. So it's basically not one of these captain's calls. It's one of these policies where some economic theory can say, oh yeah, you know, there'll be a trickle-down effect and it'll create more investment, blah, blah, blah. But ultimately, company tax cuts tend to benefit foreign investors and foreign shareholders the most. It's because Australia's dividend imputation system basically means that local investors or owners don't really benefit, because any reduction in the company tax is offset by reduced input credits. And even if you're a small business, their profits tend to be paid out to the owners, who then pay tax on their marginal tax rate. So if you cut the company tax, all it does is reduce their franking credit and then end up paying tax at the margin rate anyway. So it doesn't really benefit, you know, domestic owners that much. So it's one of these things where it'll primarily benefit foreign shareholders and foreign investors over domestic investors and domestic owners, which is why some modelling has come out by Janine Murphy, I think her name is, who found that although GDP would rise under cutting company taxes, actual national income would fall, and that's the most important thing for living standards.
Okay, Callum, I'll come back to you there. Do you think the budget is positioned to support demand moving forward? And do you think it's positioned to support demand enough, given the risks to the outlook?
In the near term, I think the budget is fairly neutral in terms of domestic demand. And I guess we can, you know, if they do make good on their promise to get back to surplus, which admittedly is fairly dubious, then they're suggesting that the federal budget is going to be a bit of a drag on economic activity over the next few years. So in that regard, I guess you could say that the budget isn't going to be fantastic from an economic standpoint. Obviously, there's a few policies in there that could prove beneficial to some extent. Obviously, they're doing some work to support the small business sector, which is good. It's going to hopefully bring forward some investment to that sector, which would boost overall business investment. In addition to that, I mean, their argument would be that the company tax is going to support jobs and, I guess, boost profitability through that as well. So, you know, you could argue that that's going to support domestic demand as well. But overall, it's a budget that's pretty light on items that are really going to have a big effect on the economy. And so I think anyone out there saying that this is a budget that's going to support jobs and growth and really, I guess, put the Australian economy on a sure footing is probably going to be a bit disappointing.
David, from there, you've long warned about the implications of Australia losing the AAA rating it has. How does the budget position us with regard to that prospect?
Well, Moody's and Standard & Poor's both responded quite unusually to this budget. They normally just rubber stamp it with, you know, a few quick comments about the solid state of, you know, fiscal Australia, but this time both of them delayed any kind of decision on it. Moody's went further than that and openly questioned most of the assumptions that we've already discussed, reframed the budget in a ongoing low commodity price environment where they see iron ore much lower, revenue much lower, deficits much higher. And they had, of course, several weeks earlier also virtually insisted that the government needed to raise taxes to deal with its revenue problem. So one, the Standard & Poor's was equivocating. Moody's was even more assertive in pretty much declaring that the budget was a pack of lies, doing it diplomatically. And so I think we're on the verge of a downgrade, certainly being slapped on negative watch. If I were them, I would have already done it. The moment I read those assumptions, I immediately concluded that we were due for a downgrade. They probably are holding off because of the election, I suspect, because if they were to actually slap us on it, give us a negative watch or indeed strip the AAA, it actually could be an election decider, I would think, especially for a coalition government, you know, that hangs its credibility on fiscal management. To have a AAA stripped a few weeks out for an election, you know, could be calamitous. So whether you agree with it or not, I suspect that they just don't want to act in that pressure cooker environment, maybe perhaps not to make a long-term enemy of the coalition, or perhaps just because they don't want to be seen to be a factor in national politics. So I suspect once we get either past the election, if nothing else happens to change the fiscal outlook, or no further than the MIEFO, when I expect iron ore will be back at $40 and probably, in fact, well below that for a short period of time during the third and fourth quarter seasonal weakness, that we will see the AAA strip. So I expect to see it lost this year now.
You expect to see it lost this year?
Yes, I do.
Okay, from there, did you find it interesting that despite the Labor Party running pretty strong on housing affordability, all of a sudden with its negative gearing reform proposals, there was not one thing in the budget which even doffed a cap in the general direction of housing affordability?
No, not really. I mean, it's pretty clear over the last few months that the coalition has privileged politics over policy in terms of housing. You know, I think there's probably quite a bit in the argument to say that if Labor had not gone so hard on negative gearing and housing taxation reform themselves, then the coalition government probably would have done it. And there's such political hacks in there that, you know, once the opposition adopts a position, it's a reflexive position for them to go the other way. And so I always expected pretty much what the budget delivered, and that was policies that are aimed much more at the Labor Party than they are at the nation. You know, everything is about positioning the coalition within a defensible narrative for the election. It's got nothing to do with what the nation requires. And that, you know, that comes into really sharp relief when you look at the assumptions. You know, again, coming back to the iron ore price especially, like, it has been so volatile and driven by wild speculative rise in futures volumes on the Dalian Bourse in China that is, iron ore has never been more unreliable at this point. The iron ore price, I mean. And so to hang your budget on such an aggressive forecast for the price is really just an 8-week punt. Like, the odds of them actually getting an iron ore price over the next 15 to 16 months of $60 is extremely low. And they can't be so stupid as to not know that. So not only that, like, within 6 months, if it collapses, by the time they get to MIEFO, the government's credibility will collapse with it. And, you know, we'll be back into the same old cycle of missed forecasts, collapsing government credibility, weighing on confidence, holding the whole kind of economy back. But they don't care about that. They just want 8 weeks of clear air to go to this election. So in that sense, no, everything was fashioned around an 8-week period. They're governing for an 8-week period in this budget.
From there, Callum, I'll come back to you. Was there anything that surprised you about this budget that either addressed something which you didn't think would get addressed or didn't address something which you did think would be addressed?
Look, quite frankly, it was a pretty boring budget overall. I mean, most of it was leaked beforehand, and the leaks themselves weren't particularly interesting, at least not compared with what had occurred in the previous 2 years. So, I mean, it all broadly happened the way I anticipated. And I think David's probably correct in that this is a budget that is designed to get them to an election. And they're basically crossing their fingers that all the assumptions hold up until then. But given the reality of what we're seeing in the iron ore market, the fact that there is so much speculation on future markets, you know, this whole situation could turn on its head at a moment's notice. So in that regard, I guess I can only say good luck to the federal government.
Well, I mean, Dalian's down 5% today after being down, 8% over the last 2 days. The iron ore price will tumble below the forecast tomorrow. Now, that's neither here nor there. It's just a couple of days. But, I mean, it's a bad optic, isn't it? And it's quite plausible, as you say, that iron ore could be at $45 come the election.
And I've seen analysis that sort of says that what's happening in the future markets is similar to what was happening in the Chinese share market last year, where it sort of doubled within like a 6-month period and then just absolutely crashed.
Yes.
So I'm guessing when the iron ore market does turn around, it's going to be sudden and it's going to be rapid. And
yes, that's right. And in fact, Chinese authorities have already tightened up a lot in various measures around the futures market, which is why some of the volumes have already come off. So it is quite a punt that they've taken.
Leith, I'll come back to you here. You've long written about the trio of shocks descending upon the Australian economy in the back half of this year. That's the rollover of mining capex, the downturn in housing construction, and the exodus of the car-making industry. Given the inherent volatility of some of the underpinnings of the budget, how do you see Australia positioned, and the government in particular, in a policy sense, to deal with those shocks moving ahead?
If the iron ore price does crash, it all crashes back down to, you know, the 40s, whatever, and there's big revenue write-offs, et cetera, in Australia, it looks like it's going to lose its AAA, and then you have, obviously, the car industry shuttering from, I think, October this year with Ford, and then Bond and Toyota early next year. But then dwelling construction coming off, well, yeah, it's going to be panic stations within the government. I mean, they're going to be looking at the one area that's basically been the big bright spot in the economy, which has been housing related spending and construction and prices and wealth effect and that sort of stuff will dissipate quick smart. And that'll hit alongside these other structural things. So it'll be panic stations. I'm not sure what the government could do at that point. I mean, they could try and roll out more stimulus like they did last time. The problem with doing that is it's going to obviously worsen the budget deficit and it's going to lead to more downgrades. So they could become caught between a rock and a hard place, which I think is going to happen anyway to whoever wins next year. But yeah, in terms of policy, it's all a little bit late. The horse has already bolted. I guess they could just look at some short-term stimulus. I don't know, try and bring back first home buyers grants or all that sort of thing. But I think it's probably too little too late.
Okay, Leith, just to pick up that point there again about housing, the Liberals have run very strong against the Labor Party's negative gearing reform policy, pointing out the risk that it poses to house prices. You'd expect them to do everything to support house prices in the wake of a downturn. The question I have, though, is apart from reintroducing a first home owner's grant, what else can they actually do to support house prices from here? What other policy is there that isn't already baked into the system?
Yeah, good question. I mean, the most obvious has already been said. That's the bring out first home buyer subsidies that worked pretty well last time. Yeah, they can do indirect stuff like they did last time where you just put cash in people's bank accounts. But if the Liberals win, I can't see them doing that, given they were so strongly against the Labor doing it last time. And I can't see them loosening the foreign ownership rules like Labor did last time, given that they've just had an inquiry and they're just trying to tighten them up. So, yeah, I think it's just basically they'll put their head between the knees and hope.
Okay, Callum, I'll bring it back to you here. How central do you think house prices are to Australia's economic and budget outlook?
Look, it's pretty clear over the past few years that the housing boom across the East Coast in Sydney and Melbourne has been pretty pivotal to much of Australia's economic transition. And if that rolls over, we do come under a lot of pressure. Drawing on what Leith just said, I think that even the Liberal government isn't going to let the housing market drop like a stone without a fight. I can easily see first home buyer grants coming back in. I could see them allowing younger buyers to get access to their superannuation.
Do you think that's reasonable policy?
Truthfully speaking, no, because I think all it really does is boost artificial demand and most of the benefits accrue to the wealthier homeowners. I mean, it's very similar in its effects to what we saw with the first home buyer grant. So generally speaking, I'd be against it. But at the same time, I can definitely see it being something that will be considered once the housing market comes under further pressure.
Dave, you got any further thoughts on the idea of what the government might do should housing prices roll over?
Well, I think Callum's absolutely right. Once the water starts lapping at the gunwales, the notion that policy process will carry the day, it becomes pretty silly. And we've already got pollies running around desperately, like mad kings doing whatever they like. If you add a crisis or even semi-crisis in terms of house prices, then you'll get all sorts of wacky options thrown up. I mean, for instance, during the GFC, at least my sources tell me that there was no first home buyer's grant presented from Treasury to Cabinet. It was Cabinet that inserted it. It was the pollies. So I think Callum's spot on. And to be honest, in that environment, if you're prepared to throw away $75 billion on subs and $55 billion on phantom corporate tax cuts and a billion here and a billion there on whatever you like, then a monstrous first home buyer's grant of God knows how much money, you know, because it would have to be larger than prior or it wouldn't have the same impact, is entirely plausible. I mean, I've sort of more or less assumed that's the case whenever I've considered my housing forecasts. The thing is, I just don't think it would work as well as it has done in the past anyway, because, you know, the market's more jaded, because if negative gearing is missing, there'd be much less investor follow through. If it's actually a stimulus measure that is happening during an economic downturn and crisis, then it's obviously fighting, you know, very large headwinds. And, you know, you can't really compare it to what happened in 2009, because back then we had this enormous Chinese stimulus driving up our terms of trade to record levels, and that wouldn't be happening again either. Plus the broader stimulus measures would be a lot more constricted because the AAA will be gone. There'd be a lot more pressure from external borrowers driving up interest rates. But that all adds up to a much less effective policy that would probably stabilise things and get prices to rise for a little bit, and then you'd just go back to the downtrend afterwards.
And would you expect that to lead to a hit for the dollar?
Not necessarily. If it's fiscal, it's more likely to stabilise or rise. It drops more in terms of monetary policy. If they cut monetary policy, that impacts the dollar more.
And it is driven to a large extent by commodity prices, which usually more than offsets what's happening in the fiscal space.
Okay, I'm just going to stick with house prices a little bit longer. Am I right in assuming that at the moment we have a softish downturn in house prices across Australia in every market but Melbourne and Hobart?
Yes.
The latest RP data figures, which I've just done up until Thursday, the 5th of May, you know, shows that Sydney's now on tear again as well. So Sydney's now surpassed its previous levels, although the index has become ridiculously volatile, where it's going up 0.5% one day and dropping 0.3% the next day. And then I've never seen the RP data index this volatile. It's all been driven by Sydney and Melbourne. So there's obviously something going on in those markets. I suspect it's, you know, we've got these two-speed markets within markets where one day you might get a whole bunch of sales from cities out of west, which are falling in value, and then next day you get a whole bunch from inner city, which are still rising, and which is causing this extreme volatility. But I don't know if that means a turning point's on or whatever, but if you look at RP data right as of right now, you know, Sydney and Melbourne are jumping again. So
I think you're right, Leif. I think that would characterise a turning point by and large, especially in Sydney, where it's a really heavily bifurcated housing market.
It's also the sudden bounce we've had is also at odds with, you know, the finance data and housing credit, et cetera, which is, you know, sort of starting to come off.
Plus the big pullback in the Chinese buyer.
And auction clearances are down well on last year, although they're still at reasonable levels. So the figures do seem odd, but, you know, for the past 6 weeks or so, they've shown a pretty big lift. Seriously, like the last 6 weeks has just been the most volatile in the series history, where Sydney, Melbourne and National have just been going up and down like a yo-yo. Which I haven't seen in the whole time the index has been out.
For me, there's big issues with the methodology of that measure, so I tend to put less weight on it when it disagrees with other measures, such as the other house price measures and mortgage lending.
You have been listening to part one of a discussion with David Llewellyn-Smith, Leif Van Onselen and Callum Pickering of CP Economics about the Australian Budget 2016. Please join us for part two.